I'm sure you're all familiar with the parable about the people in hell sitting around a feast and starving because they have really long spoons. Whereas in heaven, they have the same spoons, but everybody just feeds each other. Which is obviously stupid. You don't have to hold a spoon by the very end of the handle. We don't even do that with regular sized spoons. But even if the people in hell aren't starving, I don't think there's any question that the people feeding each other are having more fun. The concentration required to eat with a shovel-length spoon would undoubtedly be accompanied by a tense silence akin to the atmosphere in a prison cafeteria or a mall food court. Whereas people feeding each other with comically oversized spoons just sounds like an awesome theme party. I can't picture a version of that scene where people aren't laughing. In fact, it sounds less like a feast and more like a food fight that might eventually devolve into a meal. And so, even if the people feeding themselves manage to eat just as much as the ones feeding each other, they still get less out of it. And that's why you should help other people. Not because of some convoluted scenario where you have to or you'll starve, not out of obligation or even because the other person needs your help, but because deep down you know you want to, because it will make you happy. Before I go any further, I will address a common complaint I get, which is that I don't put a lot of filler into what I'm saying, and I talk too fast, so people miss what I'm saying because they're thinking about the last thing I said. And I'm not going to add any filler, so this morning I will try to slow down and leave more space for you to consider what I've just said. This is something I'm doing for you, but also for myself. If I just wanted to talk without being understood, I could have stayed home and given the sermon to my cats again. Throughout my life, I've done a fair amount of volunteering, and whether it meant tramping through the woods all night with Victoria Search and Rescue or helping people with their computers, I haven't done any of it for selfless reasons. I joined Search and Rescue because I never got to be a Boy Scout, and Search and Rescue is basically adult scouts. And I like fixing computers because I enjoy problem solving, but because I'm good at problem solving, I quickly run out of my own problems to solve. I consider myself to be a pretty selfish person. It's just that what I want isn't money. A friend once asked me why I'd spend 10 hours every month putting together the church newsletter for free rather than doing it for a business or organization that would pay me. And it's because if I wanted to get paid, I'd have to assemble a portfolio and find clients and do interviews and submit bids and figure out billing, all before I got to do the thing that I actually wanted to do, which is produce a newsletter. To me, volunteering isn't some altruistic sacrifice. It's a way to do more of what I want and less of what I don't. It took me a while to come to terms with my own selfish motives because people would thank and praise me for doing something I wanted to do anyway, and it felt like I was pulling some kind of scam. But eventually, I realized that nobody else's intentions are purely selfless either, and that's okay, because intentions don't matter. So often, when people are confronted about their use of racist, misogynist, homophobic, or transphobic language, their defense is to say, "I didn't mean anything by it. I didn't intend to hurt anyone." And the inevitable response to that, which marginalized people have had to repeat over and over again, is that nobody cares what you intended, they care what you do. Intentions are as insubstantial as evening mist and don't in any way offset the very real harm such careless words cause. But if good intentions don't excuse bad actions, then surely good actions aren't diminished by selfish motives. If good intentions are the paving stones in the road to hell, then selfish acts can be the stepping stones in a stairway to heaven. Stand-up comedy is one of the most selfish, narcissistic careers a person can pursue. The high from performing releases powerful neurochemicals that have kept many a comedian off antidepressants, myself included. And there's no one else to claim part of the credit. Even other forms of comedy require some amount of collaboration and compromise, but stand-up is a completely one-sided conversation. It's my time to say what I think, and if anybody dares to interrupt, I'm not only allowed, but expected to bully them into silence. And despite that, I can't count the number of times people have thanked me after a show for cheering them up when a loved one died, or after a hard day at work, or just for taking their mind off whatever problems they're dealing with in their lives. They describe it as a gift that I am giving to them, and I don't correct them because they're not wrong. I'm sure you're all familiar with the concept of Galilean relativity, even if you don't remember the name. When you're sitting on a train next to another train and one of them starts moving, without an external frame of reference, it's impossible to tell which train is moving. Similarly, there's a concept I'll call social relativity, where the value of an action is determined by the perspective of the observer. Regardless of the selfishness of my motives, if they perceive that they received a gift, they have, whether or not it was given as a gift. Happiness is not a currency to be exchanged in a series of zero-sum transactions. It is, in fact, the exact opposite of that. As in the parable of the long spoons, when we each give each other what we need, everybody comes out further ahead. Embrace that and become a little more selfish. Now, when I say selfish, I mean doing things that actually benefit yourself, which is not the same as doing things that you've been told will benefit you. In this late capitalist hellscape we optimistically call a society, we're conditioned from a young age to believe that having more will make us happy. That indoctrination can be hard to shake, even after decades spent trying to buy happiness without success, because there's always something new or better to want. And if we could just get a nicer car, a bigger house, or the latest iPhone, then we'd finally be happy. But the bleak, barren truth is that what we need is not what we want. In this age of choice and convenience, we all have our own TVs and smartphones and can watch what we want and talk to who we want wherever we happen to be. And yet we're more isolated than ever. PVRs and Netflix mean you never have to miss an episode, but there's also no reason to organize a viewing party. And despite these advances in comfort and convenience, or perhaps because of them, today, people are no happier than when happiness first started being measured scientifically in the 70s. What actually makes us happier is being part of a community, forming meaningful relationships, and feeling like we're making a difference, which I'm sure I don't need to tell you. If you bought into the idea that having more would make you happy, you'd be at an investment seminar right now. The hard part is figuring out what actually does make us happy. Take a moment and picture a time in your life when you were really happy. Where were you? What were you doing? Who else was there? I don't know what each of you are picturing, but I have a few ideas. You probably weren't at a bank or checking Facebook on your phone. One or two of you might have been at work, but if so, you might not have called it work. For me, there are two very distinct categories. There are things I like to do and things I like to have done. With things I like to do, like singing, playing hockey, or petting cats, the joy is immediate, but fleeting. With the things I like to have done, it's much more complicated. There may be parts I enjoy doing and parts I'm ambivalent about, but mostly it ranges from things I don't enjoy to things I actively hate doing. This may come as a surprise to some of you, but I don't enjoy public speaking. I've been doing stand-up for 9 years now, and I still dread it right up until the time I get on the stage every single time. And I'm never sad when a show gets canceled. If the church had burned down this morning, I would have felt mostly sad, but about 20% relieved. I also hate sitting down and writing and getting out of bed before 10, but anxiety is a very effective alarm clock. So why do it? Because in contrast to the fleeting joy of doing something fun, there's a much deeper, lasting satisfaction that comes from having done something. If anything, the fact that you hated it and did it anyway makes the feeling of accomplishment that much more profound. Tour de France winner Greg LeMond was quoted as saying, "It never gets easier, you just go faster." He was talking about cycling, but it applies to most things in life. You have to do a lot of things that you don't want to do the things that you want to have done. And it never gets easier, you just get better results. And it may not even be about what you want to do or have done at all, but what you need just to ward off the yawning pit of despair, which most people call a midlife crisis, and I call my semi-annual week of dissatisfaction. There was a study done in the late 70s at Simon Fraser University about morphine addiction in lab rats. The rats had the choice of pure water or water laced with morphine, and then the researchers measured how much of the morphine water each rat drank. But unlike in most rat-based science, where all of the rats are kept in separate cages to make it easier to control the variables, in this study, half were in what we'd call normal cages, and the other half were in one giant communal cage, 200 times bigger than the laboratory cages, housing about 16 to 20 rats at a time, which they called Rat Park, and which I'm sure the rats would call normal. What they found was that the rats in isolation consumed almost 20 times as much morphine as the ones living in Rat Park. Furthermore, when they moved the morphine-addicted rats into Rat Park out of solitary confinement, their morphine intake decreased to the same level as the rats already living in Rat Park. The obvious conclusion was that social isolation plays a much bigger role in drug use than the purely chemical effects like euphoria and addiction. Surely we humans are at least as social as rats. That study was published in 1981, and yet here we are in 2019 dealing with an opioid epidemic purely as a health and policing crisis, with no effort put into solving the social crises that lead people to drugs in the first place. There's a book called A Street Cat Named Bob, written by a homeless drug addict who adopts or is adopted by a stray cat, and in order to take care of the cat, he ends up getting a job and an apartment and kicking his heroin addiction. I like that book because it illustrates the 12th step of recovery programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, being of service to others without the undertones of evangelism. He didn't start taking care of the cat as a cynical ploy to improve his own self-esteem and give himself a sense of purpose, but if he had, the cat wouldn't have cared because intentions don't matter. We all need that sense of purpose, that feeling that we're doing something that matters. And maybe you can't save the world, but you can save one cat or one Syrian family, and in doing that, you save yourself a little bit. You all come to church for your own reasons. You come to be inspired and intellectually stimulated for the music and sense of belonging. But the why doesn't matter. What matters is that you come to church, and because you come, this church exists to give other people what they need. Nobody comes to church so that other people can have a sense of belonging, but that's the end result. I didn't write this sermon so that other people can be inspired, although hopefully you do get something out of it. No, I wrote this because I'm on my church's Sunday services committee, and it was easier to just do it than to convince somebody else to do it. But not only is it okay to do good things for selfish reasons, it's okay to admit it and not feel bad about it. Whether or not you grew up Christian, I'm sure you're familiar with the seven deadly sins. A lot of us can probably name more of the sins than the seven Unitarian principles. Most of the Catholic sins derive from the puritanical notion that anything that feels good is actually bad. Sloth, gluttony, lust, and pride are only sins if you believe your purpose in life is to work your whole life to benefit a power greater than yourself, which in theory is God, but in practical terms is the government and the church. And envy, well, it may not be a virtue, but it certainly is a great motivator. And there's also a fair amount of hypocrisy in the Pope lecturing anyone about greed and envy from his golden throne inside a castle in a sovereign city, subject to no law but his own. Oh no, do not direct your greed, envy, and wrath toward the Vatican and its Tolkien-esque dragon's hoard of gold. It's not your place to question your betters. But to return to the reason I brought it up, pride. The first and most serious of the cardinal sins, and according to some scholars, the basis for all other sins. The idea that feeling good is actually bad. I didn't grow up Christian, but that idea so infects our culture that I still have this nagging little worm of guilt in the back of my head whenever I feel good about helping someone. As if I should be more like Mother Teresa, even though Mother Teresa wasn't like Mother Teresa. This idea that we should work hard, help others, have hope and courage, but by God, don't you dare feel good about what you accomplish, because feeling good, or even just acknowledging that it was your work that achieved something, is the vilest of sins. You must be selfless in your acts of charity, like Jesus. Jesus, who built a following of adoring fans, told them he spoke for God and expected to be resurrected after his death. May we all be so free from pride. If you only take one thing away from today's sermon, I hope that it's okay to feel good when you do good. Pride is your reward for doing good. You don't have to be a jerk about it, but you shouldn't feel guilty either. Humans are social creatures. We weren't meant to live lives of austere isolation, and we don't need to be goaded into being helpful. Making other people happy makes us happy. It's wired into our DNA. I know the canvas is still a week away, and some of you would probably rather not think about it until you absolutely have to. But since we're already talking about giving, this year when you fill out your pledge, I want you to be selfish. Don't think of it as a gift. Think about what you get from this church and what it would cost if you had to buy it all separately, if it's even something you can buy at all. Too often, giving is framed as a negative thing, a duty or obligation, something that should hurt, but that you have to do anyway. That's nonsense. Don't give till it hurts. Give till you feel proud. Thank you.